where I have a lot of conversations with coaches that say to me, I've been doing plyometrics for years, but I move around all these different ways to try and attack it because I haven't got the adaptations that my buddy down the road is getting. And it's probably because you're not using true plyometrics, or you're not systematizing it in a way where you're able to get those adaptations, and you've actually relied far more on just the jumping actions.
Welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast, the podcast that dives into the philosophies, ideas, and practices of some of the best practitioners in high performance sport. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is all about jump training. So a couple of months ago, we had Eamon Flanagan on, who discussed true plyometrics, and that was the high-end shock training, depth jumps, drop jumps. Now, this episode with Matt is on the other end and building up to that. So not traditional true plyometrics, but jump training. So we have a little chat around deep tier jumps, and Matt explains the value of deep tier jumps. We also have a little chat around how he categorizes and programs plyometrics from the athletes that he works with in person and the athletes he works with online through his business and his consultancy. So a really interesting episode where we get a slightly different take, which is always good, from what Eamon said a couple of months ago. So if you're interested in learning more from someone that is dedicating his life and his business to plyometrics, if you're interested in that, stay tuned for the next hour, because you're in for an absolute treat. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by Vald. So I'm really proud to have Vald as a sponsor again, and after a recent visit to Vald HQ in Brisbane for their annual ValdCon event, it's incredible to see how far they've come as a company since I last visited at the start of 2018. So from a very humble office of less than 20 employees back then, it's amazing to see how far they've come. They now employ a global team of more than 200 that support clients across 100 countries, including many of the world's elite and professional sporting organisations. So an incredible rise to where they are now. So this is a huge testament to just the impact they're having across the industry with their innovation, but also continued commitment to support clients. So if you're a performance practitioner, you probably know all about Vald, but if not, I'd recommend that you check them out at valdperformance.com. This episode is also sponsored by TeamBuilder. TeamBuilder is a software for performance coaches around the world. The powerhouse platform increases efficiency, saves paper, and can handle any type of programming. It's the perfect fit for professional and academy teams, performance institutes, schools, and universities. TeamBuilder is full of tools that help coaches' needs. Multiple max tracking methods, 16 plus reports, evaluation testing, and goal setting, just to name a few. Coaches also have access to consultations with TeamBuilder's in-house sports scientist to help manage and analyze data. Head to teambuilder.com and sign up with promo code SPORTSMITH to start your 30-day free trial. So without further ado, over to the episode with Matt McInnes-Watson. Matt, welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast. It's a pleasure to get you on.
Thank you for having me on. It's as a long-term listener, I very, very grateful to be on. So yeah, I'm excited to get into some good topics today.
Well, you might be a long-term listener. Thank you for that. I appreciate the support. But I've been a long-term stalker / admirer of the stuff that you've got going on. So it works both ways. So I'm delighted to get you on. And I'd mentioned this in the build-up, in our conversations and kind of prep for this. We had Eamon Flanagan on a few month or two back talking about what he termed true plyometrics. And yep, we're going to touch on that today as part of the discussion points, but we're going to focus a lot of the time on jump training and the kind of difference between the two, which I think will be a really cool chat with you for the next 45 minutes or so. But Matt, if people don't know who you are, which they definitely should do, but if they don't, would you mind just giving us a bit of a bio? Short bio, please.
Yeah, I'll always be a high jumper. I think we always resonate to, you know, what we were as players or athletes. And my background is in the jumps community in track and field. I became a track and field coach for, you know, as I bridged being an athlete, trying to coach as I was an athlete and figuring out that didn't work. You can't do those two. I personally couldn't do those two things at once. So I was very quickly kind of thrusted into being a coach. And yeah, that was in track and field. And I also then started to shift towards more team sports. So I worked in S&C in basketball, helped out in and around football. And alongside that, I've always been very close with the research side of dynamic training. I try to put it upon myself to take a PhD on, and figured out that trying to work full time and doing a part time PhD and also then starting a business at the same time was not the best move to make. But I learned a considerable amount from doing so. It's really been a journey of trying to build a really solid systematic approach for plyometrics and dynamic movement for coaches, because it was a strange one. When I was at university, I had an S&C coach, James Grant. He was the lead of performance at our university, and he had always said to me, he was like, your knowledge from the jumps world in terms of dynamic training, it really just doesn't exist in the S&C practices at the time. We're talking the 2008 sort of era, and it was very, very typically kind of structured in a way that you start at A and finish at kind of B, and wasn't as, I'd say, as kind of free flowing as the track and field community has used plyometrics and jump training for really, the whole of its kind of popular existence. People have always been jumping, and they've always been using training modalities that have really supported how to move well locomotively, whether it's kind of plyometric or not. It's just been about managing momentum and energy effectively, because I think track and field athletes are probably the best in the world at doing so in terms of speed and velocity mixed in with those kind of explosive, more displacement-based takeoffs. So yeah, to kind of thrust forward to now, I work primarily through our business Plus Pliers, who kind of, we deliver education in plyometrics training programs and kind of consult with everyone from kind of coaches to physical therapists. So yeah, that's a kind of a short journey through where I am today and where I've come from. But realistically, I just love dynamic movement and love trying to understand how we can improve dynamic movement.
And you've made your way to Orange County, which I thought was a nice little touch. Could be worse places to live.
Yeah. I had enough of the British weather. That was enough for me to...
it does bad things to people. I'm just looking out the window now. Obviously, it's pitch black because it's 9:30, but we've had the most astonishing amount of rain this winter. It's just incredible. And it carries on, and we're well into April. But anyway, back to the plyos. So one thing we chatted about with Eamon was this jump training versus true plyometrics, which I mentioned just earlier on. I'd love to get your take on the, not only differentiation, because that may be very similar and very similar across the board, but how you interpret that and what that kind of means for you philosophically.
Yeah, I think my starting point is always considering what's happening with just standard jump training modalities. So like I call them sans plyometric movements and true plyometric movements. It's looking at movements that really evoke more of a tendon response as opposed to more of a muscular response with regards to how the tissue's interacting with the level of force that's kind of being thrusted onto you and the speed in which you're able to handle that force, deal with the incoming and use it propulsively. So looking at a distinction for me is massively important upon, number one, having a landing component in there with regards to really terming a movement plyometric for me, because we understand that if we do have a landing component to it, we can gather evidence to know realistically that we're probably getting a real dynamic pull on the tendon. So from there, we get a lot of information then as to, you know, whether someone can deal with that sort of force at that speed. Are they able to couple that incoming energy and then use it propulsively? Now, obviously, there are going to be some landing-based movements that don't kind of remain plyometric, and you might get into a much deeper ranges of motion where you just can't handle that movement. But ultimately, the research shows us that the high spike from a landing component of a movement shows us that we're going to have enough force to actually change the length of the tendon and actually get some passive reflexive energy from it. So if we're looking at like two elements here, we're looking at jumping based movements or sans plyometric based movements where they are predominantly just a takeoff action. Now it can be from like the bottom of like a squat jump where you're pausing and then just trying to find concentric action. Obviously, we know that we can't completely just be concentric. There is going to be a slight dip somewhere. So I'll kind of break it down into takeoff based actions. We have landing based actions as well, where you might step off a box and try and freeze frame. We do get that initial spike of force on those sort of landings, but we're not then using the reflexive component to that to create propulsion. And then a plyometric to me is the whole of that sequence of a landing and takeoff based action. We can also talk about ground contact times and that relation with how the tendon is evoked as well. You know, our friend Schmidt Bleacher that wrote an article in something like 92 was the one of the first people to say a ground contact time for a plyometric should be under 0.25 of a second. Now, if a movement's 0.26, who are we to kind of say that's not plyometric? And Verkhochansky initially put out that the amortization phase should be under 0.15 of a second. How we measure that is kind of, yeah, we really just can't understand where momentum kind of freezes in that amortization and isometric stance of that movement. So I think if you're getting close to 0.2 of a second and under, movements are becoming a lot more reflexive in nature, and you are using a lot more tenderness based reflexive energy. As soon as we start to creep closer to 0.3 of a second and above, so you're looking at a counter movement jump or just a takeoff based action. And obviously we can't count that with regards to ground contact time, but we can talk about it with regards to when we started to initiate that movement. So as soon as we drop into a counter movement jump, that's when we'd start to register force. It's going to be over 0.3 of a second and closer to something like 0.45 of a second. And people will then argue, maybe, you know, well, it's still plyometric, a counter movement jump. And you're like, consider how much longer it actually is taking you. If you're able to do a similar sort of movement in 0.2 of a second, but your counter movement jump takes 0.4 of a second, you know, you're playing with the difference of, here's your 1RM back squat. Now I want you to spend twice as long with that weight on your back. Like, it's those kind of considerations. When you're talking about double the amount of time, we have a completely different response to the tissue, or the tissue has a completely different response. It understands that actually we're not under tension of high force in such a rapid motion that we can actually get some length on that tendon. There's going to be some, but not enough to give us that reflexive pop that we see in a stiff dynamic landing. So that's where I kind of see those inherent differences between sans plyometric jumping actions and true plyometric actions. And really, just to kind of finish that piece, there will be some people saying to me, what about depth jumping and shock training? I think that we should start to separate that. And actually, when we look at original Verkhochansky's stuff, where we talk about depth jumping, I think that should be separate. Depth jumping is something that is really pushing, you know, people off of boxes that are in excess of half a meter. That's true depth jumping. We scale everything down to more focusing on what Bosco originally spoke about, which was drop jumping, where the aim is to be as fast on the ground as possible and to create that reactive strength capacity in someone. So depth jumping kind of sits above everything, I think, and that's how I consider it. And actually, there are, you know, many different ways to train an individual. And personally, I don't feel the need to use depth jumping really in 99% of the population that I work with. I find that you can get a lot of great work done with plyometric actions and jumping actions.
Do you think that the terminology of plyometrics becomes an issue because of how widespread it's used for everything when a human leaves the ground? Like, if you go to any gym across the world, there'll be trainers everywhere talking about plyometrics when it's not actually plyometrics. Does that actually matter? Do you think that's caused a problem with the expectation or the misunderstanding of what kind of exercise, like you've mentioned there, where on the continuum is going to get a particular adaptation? Do you think that's an issue, or is it just
I think you could compare it like this, right? You could say to someone, you could say to your buddy, you know, I live in America, you live in the UK right now. We're both doing strength training. Oh yeah, I'm squatting and I'm trying to get stronger by squatting, and so are you. You come over to America and I'm doing body weight squats, and I go over to the UK and you're doing 1RM back squats with weight on your back. And we're both assuming to get the same adaptations because that's the stuff that we've read about. We both read that doing strength training of using a squat pattern will give us X, Y, and Z adaptations. I fall very short, whereas you get those adaptations that you want. And that is where, that's where you find, in my opinion, that's where I have a lot of conversations with coaches that say to me, I've been doing plyometrics for years, but I move around all these different ways to try and attack it because I haven't got the adaptations that my buddy down the road is getting. And it's probably because you're not using true plyometrics, or you're not systematizing it in a way where you're able to get those adaptations, and you've actually relied far more on just the jumping actions and constantly searched for ways to overload those jumping actions, you know, creating things like weighted counter movement jumps, as opposed to actually, we could just stimulate that overload by using a true plyometric. We can get that stimulation through different modalities, and we can reduce the time in which you create that force. And ultimately, that's going to build a much more reactive, dynamic individual from that. Whereas there's a much more higher diminishing return and lower performance ceiling to someone that's just chasing those jumping actions or, you know, non-plyometric methods. Whereas I think the plyometric side, I think they have a much larger capacity to go, you know, just a much higher levels. There's just so much more to be gained from it. I think it becomes more specific. You know, it's still very general, but I think it can be more specific in the way that there are a lot more skills to be learned with landing and taking off and understanding where you are in space, how to organize your body effectively, how to anticipate the floor, learning how to stiffen the body in certain ways, understanding, you know, when I land, wow, that's a completely different force to what I would experience if I was carrying maybe a meter per second less velocity into that. Whereas when I'm doing a counter movement jump, or when I'm just holding some dumbbells, well, I know exactly what's going on. My body doesn't have to do much problem solving. I just have got to leave the ground. That's the only organization that I've got to do. But you imagine I'm carrying speed into something where I want to cut and change direction. Every single moment within a game, I could be carrying in slightly different velocities. And we can use plyometrics to enhance some of those skills, really, I think. So I think that's where it falls short massively.
That brings us nicely onto the next point, which is how you categorize and then systematize, as you phrased it, jumps and plyos. How do you split these things up?
So if you're going to categorize movements, so you can categorize the movement patterns themselves. So you can have, you've got bilateral movements, you've got unilateral movements. Within the bilateral movements, you've got split stance, you've got standard stance. You've got a split exchanging stance as to how you might want to use those bilateral movements. And then in unilateral movements, You've got, if you want to, you know, take off and land on the same leg, you've got a unilateral unipedal action. And if you want to take off and land on the opposite leg, you've got a unilateral bipedal movement. So that fits across every, that's all movement patterns that you can do. Now you can argue, oh, well, we can go from one leg to the other and then do X, Y, and Z. They are just variations or combinations of those five ways to move. So when I break them down, I've got bilateral movements, which are a leap to me. They could be a jump, but that's just what I've inherited as a terminology. So it could be a leap or a jump, bilateral movements. Now I'm going to do a standard stance jump or leap. I'm going to do a split stance jump or leap, and I'm going to do a split exchanging jump or leap, whatever you want to call it. And then we move on to unilateral movements. We've got bounding, our unilateral bipedal, and then we've got hopping, unilateral unipedal. And that's it. Those are the movement patterns. Now, how I then categorize those with regards to intent, I'll use exactly those methods that I spoke about before. I've got landing-based parameters, so I can fall off of something or I can take off and then try to stick that landing. Now, obviously, the unilateral ones, you're only ever going to just land on that one leg, so you're just going to have just a single leg landing. And then I'll have takeoff-based actions in the jumping modality. So we've got a static takeoff and a counter movement takeoff. And then when we go into plyometrics, I can then scale up from a very rudimentary level to the most dynamic versions possible. Now, when I coach someone or program for someone, I have three sections within my stiff overcoming section of plyometrics. So I've got light rudimentary movement, I've got medium submaximal movement, and I've got intense, what I class as ping tier based movements. So those are my stiff overcoming ones. All of them aim to be fast on the ground, but they gradually increase with intent as you move up through those. And then I also have a subcategory, which I class as deep yielding tier movements, where we're still using a landing and takeoff based action, but it's not plyometric because you drop into deep ranges of motion and you're not that fast on the ground. But it's massively valuable with regards to supporting all of the faster overcoming stiff stuff. So that's honestly, that for me is enough to then say, I can program for anyone. I can program for someone that's returning from a traumatic injury, to someone that's a complete beginner, to someone that is at the top of their sport. And ultimately, I can just find ways to sprinkle in certain components of those tiers within the plyometrics or within the jumping modalities. And it can be slotted in there at any given point within the season as well.
So we're just going to take a very quick break in the chat with Matt. Hope you enjoyed part one. So over in part two, like I'd mentioned at the start, we dive into deep tier jumps, and we have a little chat around the value that Matt has seen as an athlete, but also as a coach in this area. Just a little quick reminder, we are holding our speed conference, the Sportsmith Speed Conference at the University of Pittsburgh on the 1st and 2nd of June, so only 6 weeks away. If you're interested in coming and seeing all-star lineup from Les Spellman, Jonas Dodu, Derek Hansen, Stu McMillan, Molly Binetti, the list goes on and on. If you're interested in getting involved, head over to sportsmith.co/events and you can see more information and get your tickets there. Got a couple of questions off that. The deep range of movement that I've seen a couple of times on Instagram, which I think is really interesting. Give us the kind of rationale for that. Give us a little bit there that supports the other movements. But why would you spend time there? When would you spend time there? Mm. And give us an example and paint that picture for an exercise for us.
Yeah. So I think everyone's very familiar with like repeated squat jumps or a split exchanging motion where you drop into a deep split stance. And then you'll land, you'll almost drop that back knee down almost to the floor. You might have 90 degrees at kind of the hip, knee and ankle and that front leg. And then you'll explode out of it or not explode out of it, depends on what we're trying to train. And you'll exchange in the air, then you might drop back into that. Now, it's so funny that I inherited this from my coach and mentor, Eric Little, who inherited them from Zoltán Tenke, who was a Hungarian track and field coach who was based in Canada in the 70s. And I just assumed everyone was doing this sort of stuff. And apparently not. Obviously, certain people have been doing it forever sort of thing. But like, we had it systematically within our approach to what we did as jumpers. And it would come in at certain times of the year, or it would be sprinkled into a certain session in certain dosages. So with regards to yielding force, we have this like overcoming versus yielding. So when we want to overcome something, we want to remain as stiff as possible. We want to overcome that force by fighting it with relative levels of rigidity, and control it in a way where we're not flexing too much at a joint. Now, where I think a lot of people fall short with landing and takeoff based kind of locomotive movement is that they don't do anything with regards to yielding force. We spend so much fighting force, so much time fighting force, even when we go into the weight room. You put weight on your back to do, let's say, a back squat. I'm overcoming that force the whole time. I'm not comfortably dropping into that and controlling the force at a deeper range in that sense. So the deep yielding stuff is about controlling that velocity into those deeper ranges and being able to then reflexively propel back out of that. So as I said, I kind of always used it, but didn't realize the impact that it could have on athletes. And honestly, it goes as well as we have used it to just calm everything down on the back end of a session. We've done loads of real stiff dynamic stuff, and the sensational remedial kind of vibe to it. You know, you've done something, you've been fighting force the whole session, and now we're going to relax into things. You can do them where you are almost overcoming at depth, where you're really sending it for height. But actually, when you relax and control those movements into deeper ranges, it provides a lot of blood kind of being pumped to those muscles as well. So sometimes you get real just localized fatigue, but that kind of flush of blood to those joints is great in terms of how it makes you feel off the back of doing real stiff overcoming stuff. It's quickly becoming a great way to bridge some, you know, rehabilitational based elements as well. So when I'm working with someone that has a lot of instability at a knee joint, coming back off of an ACL surgery, that is a great way to build in a capacity at a certain range. So I'll use a full landing and takeoff based deep tier movement, but I also use oscillatory based movements, and it bridges things like yielding isometrics as well. It's kind of a step up from there. So I might sit someone in a position where they're kind of uncomfortable, and we'll oscillate in there. It's a very safe space, and we're doing loads of little repetitions. And what it does is it builds a hell of a lot of confidence, because very few people, they think about when we're trying to do really intense work all the time, we get such a small, finite number of opportunities to actually learn and get a lot out of it. But when you look at more rudimentary movement, there are so many more repetitions to it where you can do a lot more learning, and you can do things like blunt some previous trauma that you may have had in a certain individual. So when someone's returning to sport and they, you know, lack a certain competency when they move through the full gait cycle, I can get someone comfortable into mid stance and we can bounce in there, and they're like, okay, now I feel a bit more comfortable. So when I return to more dynamic movement, I can put my foot down and actually have a bit more trust in it. So it has the ability to build confidence. I think, with anecdotally saying this, there is very little evidence on it, but I think it's great for joint health. I use the phrase, it kind of greases and grooves that joint. You know, people that struggle with patellar tendonitis in their knee, just get them into a place where they kind of, you know, they feel happy in there, and they just bounce a little bit in there. And we gradually ramp up their ability to, you know, drop into a lot deeper ranges at a lot more speed. But we can do that gradually over time. I'll finish sessions with it. I'll pair them in strength training sessions. And apparently the Olympic weightlifting community are going crazy for it. That seems to be like the big thing where everyone's like, oh, I'm doing deep tier work all the time and in my training, because it's a way to overload the body in at depth, but without using an external stimulus. You're just using velocity to spike the overload, and you're not always relying on, you know, using a barbell to create that. So it's all about building comfort and relaxation in those deeper positions, especially for Olympic weightlifters, is huge, because all they want to do is sometimes get into those positions, and they're, when you've got super heavy weight on you, it's to fight and it's to be super tense. And ultimately it's about relaxing, contract, and contracting at the right time and not carrying too much tension into, it's the same with all movement really. So the deep tier is gradually kind of catching fire, I think, in terms of the directions that I'm working within, but I see more and more value with it every day.
Super interesting. Super, super interesting. Yep. And the fact that the Hungarians, it's still living in 2024.
Unbelievable. As all these things are,
as we know.
Yeah. I love the romantic stories of that sort of stuff. Like my coach Eric talking to me about doing it in the 70s and being like, the first time we did it, we were like, what is this stuff? And you kind of like, oh yeah, you know, I had a bit of leg pump. And then the next day you're like calling your coach, like, what have you done to me? I've never experienced, because as a track and field athlete, you spend all of your time super tall. So then like drop into these sort of movements where you're getting like deep eccentric kind of force put onto the body. It's like the muscle soreness immediately was just like eye opening. Like we do all this weight training and the muscle soreness didn't compare to what happened the first time we did those deep tier sort of movements. So it's like, it makes me laugh, and I kind of love to open people's eyes to those sort of things. Like velocity is also a really valuable way to overload the body in deeper ranges. It doesn't have to always be with an external overload.
Before I move on to progression frameworks, I think this may take us into that a little bit. Mm. Is the aim, so we've got this continuum from jump training to the true plyometrics and that continuum. Is the aim always to get from left to right? Or and what value is there for staying on that left side and holding back on that right side, that true plyometrics? Should we always be moving from left to right?
You know what? It's really interesting. I'm not even sure it goes left to right. I think it's two completely different spectrums.
Yeah.
And it might surprise a few people, and it kind of conflicts a little. So I listened to Eamon and I kind of conflict against it. And it's just in terms of how he presented it. And I have massive respect for Eamon. I love his work and always have done. But I mean, to a degree, I think we're also talking about the same points here, but I see that people should be entering low-level forms of landing and takeoff-based actions immediately. I think that athletes, I almost see more value in athletes learning to land and take off very early in what they're doing, and actually getting to standard jumping actions like a counter movement jump and a squat jump as a way. I would bring that in later, which sounds strange to certain people, but I find that that becomes more of an expression of force, whereas learning to manage force dynamically with all the skills and things that come in with landing and takeoff based actions, those skills have to be learned really early for me. And when I have young athletes that can do that really effectively, and also number one, can continue that through puberty and through things like peak height velocity, are of the biggest value possible. And I'll flip things on their head. I'll get athletes to strength train after they've learned how to do plyometrics. That to me is, it takes so much longer to teach someone how to be fast, how they can deal and handle incoming momentum, organize their body well, and to propel themselves effectively. And people will say, well, this is more intense than, you know, lifting weights or doing the standard jumping modalities, but we just start from a very rudimentary level, and we expose these athletes to them very gradually. So they're not going to be doing intense plyometrics straight away. And a lot of the plyometrics that I'll do are just ground-based. They are locomotive-based movements we're not necessarily using any external stimulus like a box or a hurdle. We're just using locomotive movement to teach those skills. It's learning how to anticipate the ground. It's learning how to stiffen effectively, time things well. It's learning how to relax and contract at the right time and to time everything effectively. It's learning then how to couple the energy, transition through that. Because we then get to a stage where we have an athlete that has a great understanding of how to deal with energy effectively. And the very quick gains of learning how to get stronger. I think it's such a short period of time. So I'm like, let's just wait for as long as we possibly can and have all those skills built in. And then the strength stuff can come in on top of that and really allow us then to utilize those strengths later, rather than trying to learn how to land and take off at a later point. I don't want to get to 15, 16 years of age and then bring plyometrics in. I want them to learn how to do things when they're 12 and gradually be exposed to more and more over time. And you know, it can be as lengthened out as possible. You can start with very rudimentary movement, real light, easy stuff. All these kids can do it. I'd get them to be doing deep range of motion stuff as well, because instability comes in massively. So you can just get someone at the bottom of a lunge. Let's just bounce in there. Let's see how you learn how to deal with all these components. But we see children as so weak, and actually I think that they just lack the skills to time, you know, coordinative muscles together effectively. That's the number one component to it, in my opinion. It's those timing skills. It's learning how to organize their bodies effectively, because they're just growing so rapidly. And actually the strengths will come so quickly when they get to a stage where they're maybe 16, 17. You know, it's a very general number, but you know, certain people will do it earlier or later. But ultimately, that's what I want to see. I want to see that they're able to land and take off. And we then have really unlimited directions then to go with it. We can be doing, when they get to 20 years old, they could be doing plyometrics. They could be sprinting into hopping continuously for distance. That's ultimately my goal. And it takes years to be able to do that. We're talking 5, 6, 7 years to get someone to effectively learn how to do that. So it might flip everything up on its head, but for me, it's learning skills, and physical capacities come in secondary to that.
This may have just be a rehash of what you've just said, but I had it. The first point I think I had was, what part just pure drop landings play? Because you go on social media and the things that take off is those crazy ass dudes dropping from 2 meters out. But without getting crazy, what part did they play in how you do things along that progression?
Again, something like that would come in pretty late for me. It would be, I'm searching for the kind of the cherry on top of the, you know, the cake. It very much is, for me, that's about stimulating the eccentric side of handling super high forces. And ultimately that would be the goal for it. So I find that just working on the landing side of things as well often becomes an opposing mechanism to teaching people how to land and take off. So I wouldn't teach someone, when you want to do a plyometric takeoff, you don't want to have to think about the landing. So I don't teach the landing. Let's allow the landing to be organized, you know, self-prescribed kind of organization. So that's why, again, I won't use boxes and throw people off things that are foreign to them with regards to how their body deals with those sort of stimulus. So it might come in closer to when I would bring in, you know, getting someone stronger. And obviously, you know, and I talk about strength training and all this sort of stuff, you know, athletes can be doing body weight circuits. They can be doing basic kind of levels of general strength. But when we're really chasing maximum strength and things like that, I think that the drop landings would come in at those sort of stages rather than the skill development stages of an athlete's career.
Interesting. Great. Right. One thing that I think is really key is the technical considerations and issues that you see with this skill mastery side and the things that people often get wrong or have misinterpreted and chase something that's probably not optimal. Is there anything that comes to mind when I say that?
With regards to like an execution of a plyometric?
Execution, exactly. Mm. Any common issues that you see, or things that people have read and becomes a common thing that people chase, and you're like, how have you all got this in your head that this is the right way to do things?
Catches fire sort of thing throughout the industry, or you know what you see on social media. I mentioned this yesterday actually, but I see there's a common approach to things like a pogo leap, and it's almost to overemphasize the stiffness of how someone lands, and actually doesn't pay enough attention to like the fluidity of a movement, and actually just allowing someone to learn how to change the direction of momentum rather than like just locking out your knees and just trying to like bounce on, like trying to be like an ironing board and so stiff that actually the goal of managing force is not at the forefront of it. So if I have an individual, and I've done this before, I'll say, right, be as stiff as you possibly can, and you'll see someone move and it just doesn't look smooth to me. Whereas if I get someone to be like, right, I want you to be relatively stiff, you're not going to completely sink into things, but I want you to find where you create a little bit of force, and actually not just trying to rely on the tissue to, you know, it's like, oh, it's just going to do its job, so I'm going to remain as stiff as possible. Because I think it has a very limiting performance ceiling to it. It can't go many directions then. You can't go north of, you know, being completely stiffness. You go from being like a bamboo pole to a scaffolding pole. It's kind of like, you can't go north of that sort of stuff. So what would it be like if you did just flex a little bit, but you were actually propulsively a little bit nicer out of that? And ultimately, over time, you're going to organize your body to be a little faster and quicker off of the ground than it. But when you're already super, super fast, I think it's really hard to push the force side of things and actually get more displacement for 99% of the population. Obviously, there are certain people that can do it, but it takes away the anticipative quality of almost being like, oh, I've got to really attack what I'm trying to do here. But when someone's using like a pogo leap where it's like knees are straight, chest up as high as possibly can, and I'm just going to bounce on the spot. And it's almost like seeing someone stab a knife into the ground, when actually you do want a little bit of compression there. And I then want to see some compression and expansion from that, and not completely rigid. Because I don't think rigidity is necessarily like a good phrase in the sporting world. You want reactivity, and you want reflexive capacity to do things. But when you're rigid, I don't think it's that conducive to sporting actions.
You said that you listened to the chat with Eamon. I think one thing that I wanted to put to him, I'd like to put to you, because you weighed in on the discussion, I think it was on Twitter, maybe on Instagram, can't remember, about the flat foot versus 4 foot landing, which one and when. What's your thoughts?
So I've used the term, which comes from Eric, a full foot landing. We don't like flat footed, because flat doesn't sound good. It doesn't sound like it would make a good sound. So we use the word full footed, which is, it's almost the same thing. But at the same time, people are like, oh, I wouldn't want to do it flat footed. And I'm like, no, you're not going to do it flat footed. It's just, we want to see more of your foot on the ground as opposed to being higher up on the forefoot. So we always aim for kind of dead center of the three kind of arches of the foot, which is kind of just behind the ball of the foot. There's almost like a tickle spot and reflexive spot to the bottom of the foot that it almost creates that reflexive nature of how the foot would flinch and react to force. But ultimately, it's all about stability. If I can find stability very fast in a landing, I know that I can pivot off of that foot effectively, you know, as rapid as I'd possibly like. If I'm up on the forefoot, great. If you can stay on that forefoot and the heel stays in the same position and you just propel off of it, fantastic. But the likelihood for that to happen is probably very low. And you are going to get a little bit of deformation, and your heel is probably going to drop towards the ground, and then you're going to have to propel off of it. Now, where where a real important part of it as well is that most of our sports are locomotive. You have to move horizontally when you want to, you know, sprint in football, you know, run down a basketball court. So what happens with that is we have to have a drop of the shin. And in order to get a drop of the shin, you'll have a high degree of dorsiflexion, because we ultimately want to, you know, lead some of our center of mass ahead of our foot so that we can push off of that and propel forward. So when we land in more of a full foot position, it allows the shin to drop forward and then our hips can follow on and then we can transition forward. But when you land in a forefoot or much higher up on the foot, it's a lot harder to get into those positions. So landing in a forefoot position, it number one for me is it creates stability and safety for a younger athlete as well. There are going to be certain instances, okay, when you are just going vertically in something where you can be a little bit more up on the forefoot. But ultimately, if you want to, I do very few movements on the spot. I like to use a lot of linear-based movement. Right? I call them locomotive plyometrics for that reason. I want people on the move and I want these skills to have, if we can, find some transfer there. So if we're using a leaping action, if you watch someone broad jump, they can, like repeated broad jumps, there is no way that you could land on your forefoot and transition through it. Just it would be very unlikely for it to happen. So if I can roll through a full foot and continue to propel forward, that's best for me. And you've never seen a world-class triple jumper maintain momentum by landing on their forefoot. They are landing on a full foot, and they are able to pivot off of it extremely well because of that.
Love it. Right, I've got two relatively quick fire questions next. And I love these kind of questions, if I do say so myself. Overhyped, overused aspects of jump training and plyometrics, from your opinion?
Overused, I'll go first. I will... Oh, do you know
let's,
what?
Let's bundle yeah. them together.
Yeah, overhyped, bundle them together. I was going to say, that's I think bilateral pogo leaps are the most overused thing that you can do. They have it's just a diminishing return to it. There's going to get to a stage where you need to do single leg stuff. That's enough. I'll finish it there. But yeah, pogo leaps.
Perfect. And the opposite, so underhyped, yeah. Underused aspects of jump training and plyometrics.
Is unilateral hopping. Hopping on one leg. Hopping solves almost everything that you can possibly think of. Eric, my mentor, used to use the phrase, you have movements that are indicator and remedy-based movements. They indicate what the issue is, but they're also remedial and improve those issues that you've indicated upon by using the same movement. They are unbelievable at teaching you how to prepare for the ground well. They have negative foot speed involved, which is very similar to sprinting, but they have a much higher overload portion to that. So you're exposed to enormous force. And sometimes you don't get a choice but to be exposed to that force. So someone that doesn't want to receive a super high loading from a hop, they just won't pick that foot up. So we can get you to a stage where you can pick that leg up and whip it back down to the ground. The exposure to force at such speed is phenomenal. It clears up so many potential problems that you might see that crop up regularly within your athletes. So if you're getting hamstring issues, lower leg issues, hopping prepares you unbelievably well to be ready for high force at high speed.
Amazing. 45 minutes, pretty much on the dot, as I've promised you. But Matt, thank you very much for coming on. It's an absolute pleasure to have you. If anyone wants to get to know more about your consultancy, your coaching, the business, where can people find you?
So I kind of dip in and out of Twitter, but it's both my, you know, my social media handles are at McInnes Watson, so McInnesWatson, or you can just go to plusplyos.com and that kind of encapsulates everything. And please do reach out to me with questions and whatsoever, because it, you know, it gets me going. I like to discuss some points on that sort of stuff. But I really appreciate you having me on. It's been it's good fun to get into that sort of stuff. And hopefully it sparked a little bit of interest, especially with saying that I would flip things with regards to developing an athlete, and using plyometrics earlier than the norm. But yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
My pleasure. Thank you for your time and look forward to keep in touch.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Cheers, Matt. Thanks, mate. Thanks for tuning in to episode 492 of the Pacey Performance Podcast. Absolute pleasure to talk to Matt and get his honest opinion on jump training and the importance of deep tier jumps. So really appreciate his time. It was an honor to get him on. So also big thanks to Team Builder and Vald for sponsoring this episode today. And while I've got you, if you are interested in the Sportsmith Speed Conference, we are heading to the University of Pittsburgh on the 1st and 2nd of June to host an all-star lineup from Stu McMillan to Les Spellman, Jonas Dodu, Molly Benetti, Bouchek Snyder, a whole host of stars when it comes to speed training. So get yourself over to sportsmith.co/events for more information. Big thanks to you for tuning in to this episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast, and I'll chat to you next time.